As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Let's bring in Eric Friedman, U.S. Bank Asset Management Chief Investment Officer. Eric, let's start right here and not with Ted Lasso. I'll save you, don't worry. You've asked the important question. Is this just a little correction or is this a transition into something bigger? Which one is it?
Jonathan, we think it is just a pause as opposed to a phase transition. Really two reasons behind that. Number one is we think there's this push-pull between what we're calling Horizon 1 and Horizon 2. Horizon 1 is the reopening investment horizon, the gradual mobility increases, more flights and more mobility across cities. Horizon 2 is what happens once we're already there, once that reopening occurred. And so we do think that the fits and starts that we're seeing in Horizon 1 will have corrections like this. And we also think that probably a little nuance here is the bond market is likely already pricing in Horizon 2, the terminal value of Fed funds likely lower, as well as general productivity and demographics weaker. So we think this push-pull will continue, yeah. But we're still bullish. We're still sticking with that growth mentality.
Eric, you write an extremely sober adult note. We don't see enough of those. It's from a button-down banker with belt and suspenders. I get it. When there's a phase transition, how do you know when to make that transition to a different portfolio allocation?
Tom, the biggest thing that we're focused on are really three variables. Number one is the dollar. And what we're looking at the dollar is a rise above 94, 94 and a half, the DXY, wow, or 112 in the trade-weighted dollar index. Number two would be the 10-year. We think a test of, let's call it 110 down to 1%. That would signify that the bond market is pricing a really worse Horizon 2 by our parlance. And I think the final is going to be our viewpoint on earnings. As mentioned earlier, and Taylor does a great job of this, talking about rate of change, we are in a very delicate position right now in terms of both revenue forecasts as well as earnings forecasts. If we see some deterioration there as we get deeper into this reporting season, that would signify to us that we need to come off that growth mindset, that pro-risk mindset, into more of a neutral positioning. That's where our bias is right now.
Eric, you have bond guys like Jeff Gundlach of Double Line saying that stocks are attractive on a relative basis because a 125 on the 10-year doesn't make sense. How are you thinking about relative value?
Yeah, it's a great question, Taylor. Basically, two things we're looking at. Number one is if you look at the risk premium, which is a wonkish term, it basically shows the difference between the dividend yield of global equities versus 10-year or even global rates. It's really attractive. Stocks look very attractive versus fixed income. Versus their own history, stocks are certainly in the top quartile of expensive. So we think fair value for the 10-year, Taylor, is likely around 160, 161. Doesn't mean we have to get there immediately, but our viewpoint is a gradual retracing, if you will, upward in bond yields suggests that stocks probably have a little more value here. But you have to look at them on both an absolute basis from a relative value standpoint, on a risk premium basis, as well as versus their own history. So relative value certainly favors equities over fixed income here.
Eric, what on earth is fair value in a bond market with a huge monster-sized insensitive buyer, price-insensitive buyer? What's fair value in the Treasury market these days? How do we even come up with that?
There almost are three waves of buyers, Jonathan. You have general speculations of people making bets on where 10 years go. You have hedgers in terms of mortgage, as well as pension buyers. And you have, I'd say, just a steady drumbeat of Fed participation. So tough to have an edge on speculators. But if you look at what's happening in the mortgage market, if you look at what's happening with respect to pension funds, those liabilities are getting more expensive. So that's almost like that that short gamma position continues to grow, that means people are stepping back into the bond market. So again, we think that positioning gets cleaned up and a gradual retracement up to that 160 level is more likely. But again, it will happen on a very phased, very gradual basis.
Eric, we've got to leave it there. It's good to catch up, sir.
Right now in the pandemic, it has been a joy to speak to Bakhti Ansari with Johns Hopkins, her expertise in emergency medicine. I want to go there today, Bakhti, instead of the geography that you are expert at. In emergency rooms at the Johns Hopkins Hospital, there's got to be a certain percentage of people working there who are unvaccinated. There's got to be a certain percentage of people coming into the emergency room unvaccinated. What do you do?
So regarding employees of Johns Hopkins Hospital, we are vaccinated. We all do show our vaccine status that is now documented and recorded. Regarding unvaccinated patients, we have that knowledge on who's vaccinated and who's not. My practice is to gown up and be ready if I'm unsure of their vaccine status or their COVID status.
Doctor, I was very surprised to read the following stat in the New York Times that around 60% of workers in the city's public hospital system are vaccinated. Given what's happened in the last year, I would have expected that number to be far, far higher. Where is that resistance coming from, Doctor?
So we feel like a lot of that resistance is coming from our ancillary services. There are still individuals who, despite working in public health hospitals, have misconceptions or concerns around the medical systems, have vaccine hesitancy, have victims of misinformation. And so it is really difficult to prove a counterfactual, and that is something we're still struggling with in all sectors of society, not just public health hospitals.
Doctor, many people are characterizing this as a political party issue. Do you think that's helpful?
It is not. This is not a political party issue. This is not a national issue. This is a global issue that affects every single one of us. Until we reduce the amount of circulating virus and we get vaccinated, we don't get to return back to normal. And it's as simple as that.
Doctor, are the vaccines effective against Delta?
Vaccines are effective against Delta. It is very common to see individuals who still get sick despite having vaccines. We see this every year with the flu. The Pfizer vaccine study show 88% effectiveness 2 weeks after getting your second dose. But that does mean that 12 out of 100 people will potentially still get the illness. But we know that it's the disease-sparing vaccines. They're less likely to be severely ill, less likely to end up in the ICU, less likely to die.
What do you think it's going to take to see if schools can 100% reopen or not in the fall? We were having a conversation here that the markets perhaps might actually believe that something is wrong if schools don't reopen, if that is the catalyst. What do you think it takes for us to get there?
You know, I think we've learned a lot about how to reopen school safety. In the spring of this year, my daughter's school opened. They used pods. They, they created pods of play. Classrooms didn't interact. There was temperature checks. Yes, you know, it's a bit strange taking your child and you get a temperature check every morning. But I felt perfectly safe that my child was in school with the precautions that were put in place.
Bakhti, I want to talk to you about bacteriology and microbiology because I just don't buy this for a minute. We cured ourselves from the horrific child killer diphtheria. I was on the back end of polio. Taylor, I believe, or Anne-Marie mentioned earlier, Senator McConnell's battle personally with polio. I don't buy it for a minute that we haven't done this before. From bacteria, we got vaccinated. From viruses, we got vaccinated. What's different this time?
There's nothing different. Vaccine innovations have been ahead of the curve. Luckily, we had the mRNA vaccine studies that were done for cancer drugs, which allowed us to find a suitable vector for the vaccine and implement it rapidly. We also do have viral vector vaccines as well, which are extremely innovative. So nothing is different. We have actually used all of our lessons learned and applied them to the COVID-19 right. pandemic. The challenge is therapeutics. So with bacteria, we have antibiotics that affect the ability of the bacteria to reproduce and stop infection. Viruses have always been more tricky due to the way that they replicate.
How do we incentivize these people? I mean, people are saying, give them money. Do this, do this, do this. How do we get this fixed at a Joe Biden speed?
So there is two groups. there is the hardcore conspiracy theories, vaccine
skeptics. They're never going to be.
Right?
I get it.
You cannot change, right?
I got it.
But the majority of the people are people that have, A, underestimated their vulnerability to getting sick. Second, overestimated the side effects of the vaccine. And because they're kind of just lost, they chose to do nothing. Now, that is a group that we target. We need to promote positive messaging around the vaccine. We need to educate people with clear, concise facts about the true risks of vaccination and stop overinflating the few side effects that have been seen or the isolated cases in social media.
Do you think full authorization would help push this issue forward and move away from just emergency use authorization of these vaccines?
Unfortunately, yes, right? So I think for the lay public, the difference between full authorization and emergency use authorization is one of the big sticking points in their vaccine confidence. The truth of the matter is the way that these studies were conducted was rigorous, just as we would have conducted any other new drug intervention study. Due to like the national reporting software, the VARES software from CDC, we have national reporting on vaccine side effects, which is phenomenal. And the use case here is in the millions. And so I think that having that sticky label that says this is fully authorized, I think will improve people's confidence. Yeah. Although scientifically, it is unnecessary.
Doctor, we appreciate your effort, that's for sure. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. Dr. Bhakti Hansati there, Johns Hopkins University Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine, on some of the issues, Tom, and those issues are always far more complex than some people make them out to be.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Right now, we go to your content, where content is king. Michael Nathanson with Craig Moffett. At Moffett Nathanson has just been spectacular on all of his stuff that we watch at home. And is there really an opportunity to make money at it? Michael Nathanson, where's the profit? Megan Desai at LSE says it's all about profit. It's all about getting out there and making money. Is there an identifiable profit in the streaming business?
At this point, there isn't. The profit is going back to consumer. Given all the discounting that's being done, the consumer is grabbing the profit, and companies are subsidizing consumers' content habits at this point.
Comcast was able to make that shift in cable TV to get to real profit, to real cash flow. Do you model an equivalency here to what Comcast did in cable TV, or is this time different?
This time is different. You know, Netflix is the only company in the next 3 or 4 years that we think will make money. Money just defined as free cash flow. We just see big black holes everywhere, right? And that's why you had Discovery Warner's merge. That's why Comcast Viacom is rumored to get together. These businesses are really capital intensive. I don't think they have the same dynamics as the linear businesses that we all covering years ago.
And Michael, this seems to be a broad sector call. And that's what gets my attention here. This is neutral Netflix, neutral Walt Disney Company, neutral Roku. You see this across the board here.
Jonathan, the problem is, and I think it's to your previous guest about the cost of money, you've got to look out 5-10 years to see valuation here be supportive. To me, that's just a long way to go. And everyone's so confident about their data points that I just take the other side of this trade, right? I mean, we know streaming is the future, but the market has overpriced these assets. I'm just going to wait for a better entry point at this point in time.
Let's talk about what would it take for you to say I'm wrong. Always a good exercise, right, Michael. What would it take in the coming year? Is there anything?
Well, I would say a couple things. One is, our view is that the U.S. is a very competitive market, and it's hard to eat profits out in the U.S. streaming business. I think you need to see more people move into the sidelines, right? You would see more consolidation. You would see Apple and Amazon, kind of step back. And you would start to see, you need Netflix to start growing more quickly in the U.S., which would point to a higher upside, penetration case, right? So I think here you need competition to lessen, and you need, growth to actually start reaccelerating again. So that's one. And then secondly, I think internationally, you would really need to see some of the developing markets where there's very low consumer pricing really start to show signs of pricing power. So those are, to me, the two things, because, you know, the profits right now are in the U.S., potentially, and the growth is coming from low market places like India, low pricing markets. They just don't have great returns on invested capital.
And Michael, I've heard this a lot. The U.S. customer is more profitable than an international customer. How do we get them to be even? How long does that take?
Well, it goes to, you know, a big part of the international story is developing markets, right? So you have Latin America and Asia Pacific as the drivers of growth. But those price points are really low, right? The rest of the world price point outside Europe could be one half to one third the price of American customers. So it's just going to take a long time, Taylor, for pricing to start elevating, right? And before the pricing can elevate, you need to give consumers a ton of content to make the product sticky, right? So you need to invest. And this is the biggest challenge. You need to invest tons of billions of dollars to make the content sticky enough to hold on to customers and then to drive pricing, right? So it takes years of investment to get to that place in which you start raising pricing again.
The other point that you made pretty well is about consolidation. I was reading another of your colleagues' notes talking about Amazon purchasing MGM for about $8.5 billion. Why isn't Netflix making more purchases? Should they be? What does consolidation in the industry look like to you?
Yeah, there's not a lot they can do. I mean, the biggest reason why you make a bet on MGM is for franchises, right? The speed at which Disney built out their direct-to-consumer business is due to the speed tied to their ability to really lift the Marvel, Pixar, Star Wars universe, you know, in streaming. So, but there's just not a lot of franchises like that still available. MGM has a few. Netflix is going to do this. MGM is really not a lot that I see available to be bought. I worry, as the analyst covering the industry, that you're going to see Apple and Amazon put even more money to work in streaming because, they have other reasons to do it besides trying to make a profit.
Michael, just a bit of a tricky line this morning, so we're going to have to cut it short. But, we always enjoy catching up with you, sir, and we enjoy your work too. Send our regards to the team. That was Michael Nathanson, Moffitt Nathanson Senior Research Analyst.
This is a joy because he has done public service for America across so many areas, including ambassador to Japan and now senator from his Tennessee. Bill Hagerty joins us, the Republican from Tennessee, this morning. Senator Hagerty, I have to go to the stunning Washington Post analysis this morning of the unvaccinated. You are a leading spokesman on this. How are you going to convince the unvaccinated of your Tennessee to get it together and get vaccinated?
Well, I think we're off to an incredibly good start thanks to Operation Warp Speed. I don't think there's enough credit given to the progress that we made here at an unprecedented level here in America. In Tennessee, I've been very clear. I've taken the vaccine. My mother, who is 89 years old, has taken the vaccine. I lead by example. We continue to encourage people. It's a personal choice for folks, of course, but I've certainly been clear that I've looked at the data, and I think the right decision, certainly for me and my family, was to do just that.
How do you sell it? We talked to French Hill of Little Rock the other day with the same challenges. I would suggest Arkansas, frankly, a grimmer story than any Tennessee. But what's the prescription you have with your knowledge of Nashville media and Tennessee business? What's the prescription? What's the plan to jumpstart this as we hear from President Biden?
I think as we look at where we're headed right now, the numbers continue to look much better fatality. And we just need to continue to talk about that positive outcome, that positive result, and encourage people to continue to get behind it. As school reopens, things get back into the swing of things, we'll probably see another pickup in inoculations.
One final question on this, Senator, because I know Taylor Riggs has some important questions as well. Senator Hagerty, what do you need from former President Trump to send a message to the unvaccinated?
President Trump is having a hard time sending any messages thanks to the censorship of big tech. His normal means of communication has been incredibly stifled. I think that's incredibly troubling. In terms of his message to people, no one worked harder than President Trump to put a vaccine in place. I think people know that. I think he can convey that. But he put a tremendous amount of work in place with Operation Warp Speed to make this vaccine possible, not only for America, but for the rest of the world. I think that's an incredible example. He should talk about that when he can.
Senator, pivot with me, if you will, please, to infrastructure. What is the path to a bipartisan $579 billion infrastructure deal?
Very hard to say. Chuck Schumer today is planning to put a procedural vote in place to start the process on this. Yet we haven't seen any text. We don't know the content of it. I haven't seen anything. This sounds remarkably similar to something that we've all seen before. You remember you have to pass the bill before you can see what's in it? Obamacare 2.0, that didn't work out well for America. So we have a lot to see and a lot more work that needs to be done before I can comment on exactly what's in the bill and how we should proceed on it.
Is this two-path approach still the right way to go?
Well, certainly not the path that I would take. I'm a businessman my entire career. I step back and look at this and say, what's happening here? You've got a two-path process, one that a lot of effort has gone into play. I think I respect my colleagues who have worked hard to put a bipartisan plan in place. But as you know, when you negotiate a deal, often what's even more important is what you negotiate out of a deal. Yet we've got the Biden administration, we've got Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer talking about pushing everything that was negotiated out of the deal right alongside. In fact, Nancy Pelosi has said that she's not going to even look at the bipartisan deal unless the completely partisan reconciliation package is put forward too. I wouldn't call it a reconciliation package. It's just another reckless tax and spending program that they're trying to shove through, a massive program, something that we've never seen before. And I think it's going to have devastating effects on the economy. So I'm very concerned about enabling this partisan package to go through under the guise of a partisan
Thankfully, I do.
Infrastructure package that's far smaller.
Senator Hagerty, I am fascinated what your prescription is for your Republican Party. So many of the interviews we have with Republicans and with Democrats is a liberal tranche of the Democratic Party really troubling for moderate Democrats. Do the Republicans respond to that by being more staunchly conservative or by moving to a Lamar Alexander-like middle?
I think what we need to do is continue to convey what's actually happening here. We need more business people like me in Washington. I think that's the point. We have a hard time conveying the essence of what's occurring here. But right now, what we're doing is we've already seen a $1.9 trillion package move through on a wholly partisan basis back in March of this year. That's roughly 10% of our GDP. They're talking now about dumping 20-25% more of our GDP into this so-called infrastructure package. It's going to be massively inflationary. We need to convey that. And when we hear moderate Democrats like Joe Manchin say he doesn't want to put something through that isn't paid for, he doesn't want to increase the debt. Mm-hmm. These are things that we need to push back on and say, well, if it's going to pay for itself, you've got to look at how they're talking about paying for it. And if they're talking about crushing taxes on job creators, if they're talking about killing capital formation by putting capital gains taxes in place, those types of policies are going to be devastating to our economy.
Right.
The American public is smart enough to understand this. We need more business people talking about this in a way that's rational and easy to understand.
Senator Hagerty, I wasn't going to bring this up, but you mentioned private business in Washington. I need you to comment this morning on the jailing of the private equity gentleman from Los Angeles, Tom Barrack. What were your thoughts when you heard of these actions by justice?
Well, I've only seen a headline or two, so I don't know anything about the specifics of the content of this case or what it has to do with private equity.
Well, it doesn't have to do with private equity, but certainly it is of note here as well. Senator Hagerty, thank you so much for joining us today. Bill Hagerty, he is of Tennessee. Greatly appreciate that.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Do you want to go to Thomas Kosterg on Tyler from Love
Island?
I'll go
to Thomas Kosterg right now, pick day, to save me as well. Jamila's in my ear. Boundaries, Tom, boundaries. Thomas Kosterg, pick day wealth, joining us right now.
Good morning.
And within his within his research, I'm going to ignore you, within his research note is a really, really important observation on America's savings pile. He's optimistic we're going to spend a little bit of that savings pile over the next year to advance the American economy. But Thomas Kosciusko, what happens in a couple years to that still massive savings pile?
Right. So the savings pile right now is around $2.5 trillion. And so the question for the economy is how much will be spent within the next year and within the next few years. Actually, I think, a small amount of that will be spent, but a small amount, which I think will be around 10 to 15% within the next year. But 10 to 15% of a big savings pile, it's still a big amount of consumer spending, which will be, flowing into the economy in the next few months. And that's why I'm quite cautiously optimistic about the U.S. consumer and therefore U.S. GDP in the coming month, even though we are going to see a deceleration in growth, that's for sure. But I think the U.S. consumer will stay quite resilient.
Do you believe that our savings pile, as you call it, has a permanent feature to it, that it's a permanent fixture of how we believe and think?
Well, I do think that, yes, indeed. I think some of that, part of the savings went into the equity market, went into long-term savings, and will probably not go back into the economy. But I think, part of it will be spent, point number one. And also, I do believe in credit card lending. I think credit card lending has also some upside potential in the coming weeks and months, and that will also support consumer spending. If we get, say, 50 to 100 billion more in credit card lending, that will be very helpful for growth. Because you're right, we have a lot of tailwinds are going to fade in the second half of the year, including the reopening, the fiscal support, so things like that. We also have some headwinds from the Delta variant. But I think the U.S. consumer will be able to be resilient.
Thomas, to what degree do you think Q4 is going to shape the outlook for the whole cycle? Not just the following year, the year after, but the whole cycle?
Right. So the thing with the U.S. cycle is that we're going back to potential growth, right? So we're going back to the trajectory before the pandemic. And that matters because that's usually a signal that we're mid-cycle. And we know that when we're mid-cycle, growth is getting harder to get. And the situation becomes more fragile, more difficult, more, there are more risks. So it is true that 2022 could see more risks. However, again, I think, the U.S. consumer can propel growth. I also think we could have more lending in the economy, very accommodative financial conditions, despite the Fed's tapering. And so that could help sustain growth going forward, even though from a pure metric perspective, we're already mid-cycle and we have more risks.
So Thomas, potential, what is potential in the U.S. economy? What is it now? Two, sub two?
Yeah, I don't think potential growth has changed that much. I think it's still around 2%. The problem is, again, that we have, weak demographics. Birth rate is especially a concern. I think we don't have enough babies in the U.S., but also I think in Europe as well. And that's definitely an impediment to growth. And with regards to innovation, innovation is there and it's actually even more prevalent in the U.S. than in Europe. But still, I think innovation is still failing to really broaden out and to spread through the economy. I think that's the problem. So productivity growth may pick up, but it won't be a massive pickup going forward.
Are you confident that peak inflation is also behind us?
Right. So regarding inflation, it's a bit complicated. Right now, we have the bottleneck inflation. So we have, scarcity of some products. But next year, we'll have the cyclical inflation, because usually inflation comes with a lag. So you have the recovering growth, and then 1 year later, you have the bounce in inflation. And so 2022 may still see inflation above 2% for cyclical reasons. The real question is about 2023. And then I think that the jury is out. I think some deflationary forces still apply, but I keep an open mind because, two forces that I'm watching are globalization and especially the U.S.-China tension, which could lead to potentially an erosion in globalization and more inflation in the U.S. And also the share of labor in the economy and whether wages are go up more. But I think that's a topic for another day.
I know I'm simplifying this, so bear with me. You've had a few senators come out and saying that this inflation is effectively a tax. So you've taken away all of those wage gains that you described because of that inflation. How do you think about that?
Right. I don't think wages are a threat to inflation until we get to, say, around five-ish or more on wage growth. And, you know, we're not there. We're at 3.2 on the Atlanta Fed median wage growth number. So we're still well below levels that could be dangerous for inflation in the sense that they will lead to a self-perpetuation of inflation above 2%. So, you know, we're not in the danger zone for in terms of wage growth. And actually, I think wage growth still has room to go up without threatening inflation.
How is that? How do you get wage? Do you get back to a constructive and positive real wage, and it does not affect inflation?
Right. I think the correlation between wages and inflation is actually much more fragile and much more tenuous and slim than widely appreciated. I think the real danger comes above 5% on wage growth, and especially on the Atlanta Fed median wage. You have to look at median wages. Really, it's how, you know, someone staying in the labor force and staying in the same job, how his or her wage compares through time. I think that's the key indicator. And so to me, the key indicator is the Atlanta Fed median wage growth number. And again, we're at 3.2% right now, year on year, and it's still very quite soft. So I would not worry until we reach, say, 5%. We're not there yet.
And John, the run rate on the Atlantic Fed, I totally agree with Thomas on this, on the median aspect of wage growth. We got to get back to 3.6%. John Farrow, to really get there. We're not there yet.
Tom, I'm smiling because only economists call 5% wage growth dangerous. Will you find anyone else that calls 5% wage growth dangerous?
I agree.
Thomas, why totally is it? Agree. Just let's finish there. For a lot of people who might have accidentally tuned in this morning, trying to find something else, maybe some sports, I don't know, and stumbled across some economists talking about the labor market, what's dangerous about a 5% wage hike?
Right, because then it starts to affect inflation expectations, and you have also, wage gains starting to outpace productivity. So this is based, this reasoning that I have is also based on historical relationships. We have to go back, in time to see wage growth of above, 5%, I think, in the early 1990s.
Yeah.
And then you had inflation sustainably above 2%. And it was a time when actually central banks were struggling to bring down inflation. I think right now the problem is that they're trying to move it up. And so I think those days of the early 1990s are probably gone, and they're unlikely to go back. But I might be wrong, but so far I don't see them.
Thomas
in terms
Costa
of wage growth.
Of PICTEF Wealth Management, senior U.S. economist. Thomas, good to catch up, sir.
Thank you.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.